All eyes are on Moscow after Washington and Kyiv reach an agreement.
So I'm very skeptical that the Kremlin will say, yeah, sure, unless they just try and play along, sort of play Trump along, as it were.
Trump says more tariffs are coming.
We have been abused really for a long time, and we will be abused no longer.
And just how prepared is the U.S. military for future conflicts?
While the U.S. Navy is still considered the most powerful in the world when it comes to firepower and tonnage, the number of U.S. Navy ships is falling behind China's.
Today is Thursday, March 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Following Tuesday's blockbuster news that the U.S. and Ukraine have been able to repair their diplomatic relationship and agree to terms for a ceasefire in the Russia-Ukraine war, the U.S. administration's efforts are now putting pressure on the Kremlin.
Moscow has made considerable territorial gains, and some in Russia say they are prepared to give up nothing. We have this report from our team in Moscow.
Moscow this week suffered the biggest Ukrainian drone attack since the start of the war, leaving at least 3 dead and 17 injured. Many Muscovites are trying to ignore the war, but many also hope that negotiations between the Kremlin and the new U.S. administration will soon bring a peace that Russians consider a victory. Officials say the goal is international recognition of the new borders that the Russian army has obtained by force. Alexander Komarenko is a former Russian ambassador.
It is clear that there will be a bilateral settlement between us and Kyiv. It should be a peace treaty that will legalize the new borders of Russia and the post-Soviet borders of Ukraine.
Many in Moscow are already celebrating the new geopolitical scenario before the conflict has ended. Evgeny Fyodorov is a deputy in the State Duma for the ruling United Russia Party.
This is a real victory. You can open champagne. Also, it cannot be lost. Russia must continue the offensive because no one canceled the ambitions of the United States. Yes, they are afraid of us, but it does not mean that they abandoned their idea of a world empire.
After more than 3 years of war, independent media outlet Media Zona counts more than 95,000 Russian casualties. But these losses are not stopping the Kremlin from carrying on with the war. In a meeting with wives and mothers of deceased soldiers, Russian President Vladimir Putin said there would be no concession.
We are not going to do that. We must choose for ourselves a version of the world that would suit us and that would ensure peace for our country for a long historical perspective.
Critics of Putin can only speak from exile. As they see it, the Kremlin could make concessions, but giving up its territorial ambitions is out of the question. Anton Berbashin is editorial director of the Russian analysis group, Riddle.
Compromises can be presented on some other issues related to how the Ukrainian security architecture will be formed after the war. Moscow wants to be a participant in the formation of this new Ukrainian security architecture and, in fact, to describe what can be done and what cannot be done.
Russian officials are looking forward to a meeting with U.S. officials following the talks between U.S. and Ukrainian negotiating teams in Saudi Arabia. So far, there is no such gathering in sight. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
As we've heard, the world is looking for a response from Moscow. Is Russia ready for a ceasefire? Taras Kuzio is a professor of political science at the National University of Kyiv, Mohyla Academy. What are your initial impressions? A path to a ceasefire, does it look good to you?
I'm glad that my expectations were of it being a lot worse haven't borne fruit. The actual final document was, I think, quite good from the viewpoint of Ukraine. With all of the kind of last few weeks, which have been heavy on attacking President Zelensky, attacking Ukraine, going down on Ukraine and saying nothing about Putin and nothing about Russia, I think many of us were expecting this communique to actually be a lot worse than it was. So it's come out quite well, I think, from that vantage point of view. And it's good that the Ukrainians managed to push the fact that they want the Europeans on board in the whole process. Of course, I will just add that, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about this, I've always been very skeptical that the Russians will play ball, but we can go on to that.
Well, that's going to be my next question. A lot of American officials are saying the ball is now in Russia's court to show the world if they actually want peace or not. So what do you think?
Well, I think that the Trump administration, the Trump team, or whatever you want to call it, simply have no understanding of the roots of why Russia launched a full-scale war. And they've never mentioned this key phrase that the Kremlin always brings up, which is the roots of the war. The Kremlin keeps talking about the need to remove, to end the roots of the war. It's as though the Trump administration doesn't understand. This is like the key thing for the Kremlin, and it's not changed. It's been the same since spring of 2022. They've stuck to this phraseology. And that phrase, that question of the roots of the war means there's a massive gulf between Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, who wants to be seen as a peacemaker, Ukraine, the aims of Ukraine, which would like the war, the bombing and the war and the killing to end. The roots of the war have not been fulfilled in Russia's eyes.
So what are the roots of the war?
Well, the roots of the war are it's the Belarusianization of Ukraine, or little Russianization of Ukraine, either one. It's the goal of the special, so-called special military operation was to destroy Ukrainian identity. That's denazification. And the to annex the southeastern so-called New Russia part of Ukraine, plus, of course, what had been taken earlier, Crimea and the Donbass. The rump Ukraine, what was left of Ukraine, would become a Russian satellite state like Belarus under Lukashenko, kind of a little Russia. And these Ukrainians who had been misguided into believing that they are different to Russians would be re-educated, forcibly if need be, to understand that they're really Russians. I mean, this process that I'm talking about is taking place on the occupied territories, where you have a massive program of de-Ukrainization, Russification, and even Sovietization. And so that that sort of goal for Ukraine, not allowing it to exist in its current form, as it were, is what they mean by the roots. And they actually specified back in the spring of 2022, they actually, it's about three or four pages of legislation that the Kremlin demanded that Ukraine repeal. And this is kind of legislation primarily on things like the, you know, religion, culture, education, language, memory politics. A lot of this was adopted after the Euromaidan revolution. Of course, these kinds of demands Ukraine will never meet. And on top of this, there's the whole question, of course, of the Trump team saying, "We'll, you know, Ukraine should postpone joining NATO for 10 years, whereas Russia is saying never." And so these roots, which are the goals of the so-called special military operation, have not been fulfilled. Russia hasn't expanded the amount of territory it controls compared to 3 years ago. It's still about 19% of Ukraine, and they don't even control any big large cities like Kharkiv, which is close to the Russian border. So I'm very skeptical that the Kremlin will say, yeah, sure, unless they just try and play along, sort of play Trump along, as it were.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for today. Taras Kuzio teaches political science at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy. Professor Kuzio, thanks so much for your analysis today.
Turning to the economy, President Donald Trump threatened more tariffs on goods from the European Union as major U.S. trading partners, like Canada, said they would retaliate for trade barriers already set by the U.S. Reuters' Jillian Kitchener has the story.
We have been abused really for a long time, and we will be abused no longer.
President Donald Trump on Wednesday threatened to escalate the global trade war with new tariffs on trading partners.
More tariffs on the EU. Will you respond to their retaliation?
Of course I'm going to respond.
That's after the European Union and Canada retaliated against his 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports.
The European Union treats us very badly.
During a meeting with the Prime Minister of Ireland, Trump said it was among the countries abusing the United States.
The EU was set up in order to take advantage of the United States.
Including Ireland? Is Ireland taking advantage of the US?
Of course they are.
Canada, the biggest foreign supplier of steel and aluminum to the United States, announced its retaliatory tariffs on billions of dollars of U.S. products starting Thursday.
We will not stand idly by while our iconic steel and aluminum industries are being unfairly targeted.
Canada's finance minister, Dominic LeBlanc, said it was a dollar-for-dollar approach.
25% reciprocal tariffs on an additional $29.8 billion of imports from the United States. These tariffs are in addition to Canada's 25% counter tariffs on $30 billion of imports from the United States in response to U.S. tariffs put in place on March 4th.
The EU's countermeasures are due to take effect next month, targeting up to $28 billion worth of U.S. goods.
That's Jillian Kitchener of Reuters reporting.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is launching a new initiative to reform the United Nations as it approaches its 80th anniversary. Guterres says the 193-member global organization needs an urgent update to deal with major funding reductions and still tackle the world's challenges. Guterres said the UN initiative aims to make its work more efficient and consider structural changes to streamline operations.
Portugal has slid back into political uncertainty after its third government fell in as many years when Prime Minister Luís Montenegro lost a confidence vote in parliament. President Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa is expected to dissolve parliament and then announce new elections that many expect to likely be set for May. It's the worst spell of political instability since Portugal adopted a democratic system in the wake of the 1974 Carnation Revolution, which ended a four-decade dictatorship.
China, Iran, and Russia conducted joint naval drills Tuesday in the Gulf of Oman, offering a show of force in a region still uneasy over Tehran's rapidly expanding nuclear program and as Yemen's Houthi rebels threaten new attacks on ships. It's the fifth year the three countries took part in the drills. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Looking now at American politics and the U.S. military. The United States says China is the biggest threat to national security, but as VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports, while the Chinese Navy keeps growing, the number of ships in the U.S. fleet is decreasing.
The U.S. Navy, 296 ships strong. Thousands of companies build the parts and maintain them, including Fairbanks Morse Defense, the largest engine manufacturer in North and South America.
This engine has about 10,000 horsepower.
CEO George Whittier tells VOA 90% of the company's business goes to the U.S. Navy or Coast Guard. The company, he said, expected the size of the Navy fleet to increase to match Navy force structure goals that get bigger every year. But in recent years, the fleet decreased. Last year's budget funded just six new Navy ships, while decommissioning 15 from the fleet.
And then for the 2025 budget plan, originally that was supposed to be 10 new ships, and now they're only going to asking for six new ships again, and they want to decommission 19. So that's then down minus 13.
While the U.S. Navy is still considered the most powerful in the world when it comes to firepower and tonnage, the number of U.S. Navy ships is falling behind China's. Its Navy is on pace this year to surpass 400 ships, according to the Pentagon.
It's very frustrating and very challenging to be a supplier. They're rapidly growing the size of their Navy, and here we are on the sidelines. It's, you know, we need to get more ships that are out there.
We send a shipbuilding plan to Congress every year.
Admiral Jim Kilby, the acting chief of naval operations, agrees.
And we've advocated for a bigger Navy for a long time.
But he says he hasn't had the budget to replace all his aging ships and submarines, much less grow the force.
And when we get a new ship, we'll replace an old ship because that old ship is more expensive and harder to maintain.
Whittier says the lack of growth isn't just slowing the maritime defense industry, it's sinking the supply chain.
There's thousands and thousands of suppliers that have gone out of business, and it's a real risk. I got a note from the folks at Electric Boat that make the submarines, and they'd identified something like 350 critical suppliers where they were concerned if they go out of business that they don't necessarily have a backup.
Fairbanks Morse Defense happens to be one of the biggest suppliers to U.S. submarines and the sole U.S. company supplying the biggest engines used in the military's amphibious warfare ships.
Without four of these, an amphib is nothing but a piece of metal floating in the water.
Each engine, about the size of a small school bus.
We should have two engine suppliers. But the reality is if the Navy's only going to build six ships a year, it's a struggle to keep one engine supplier in business, let alone two.
A problem so concerning, the president is taking action, announcing this month a new office in the White House devoted entirely to shipbuilding.
We used to make so many ships. We don't make them anymore very much, but we're going to make them very fast, very soon.
Congress is expected to increase the military's budget to surge resources for its shipbuilding shortfalls. While most ships made in the United States are for its military, Senator Mark Kelly tells VOA the state of U.S. commercial shipping is even more dire.
We went from 10,000 ships during World War II to 85 today. So in case of an emergency, in case of a conflict with a near-peer adversary, we're quite limited to getting all those supplies and equipment, troops across the ocean.
The United States builds about five commercial ships each year. China builds more than 1,000.
They have one shipyard, just one shipyard, that's bigger than all of our shipyards put together. They can construct them very, very quickly. And we just don't do that anymore.
Kelly, in December, introduced bipartisan legislation called the Ships for America Act. The bill aims to increase the U.S. commercial fleet by 250 ships in 10 years, which will also increase the supply chain for military ships.
A lot of the parts that go into a U.S. aircraft carrier, some of those same parts for those systems go in merchant ships.
Kelly says the bill uses tax incentives and fees on cargo coming into the country to fund the growth.
There are provisions in the legislation to have it fully paid for, so we don't have to add anything to the annual deficit.
Defense industry leaders say they welcome efforts to prioritize shipbuilding to help counter China and warn inaction will put the U.S. even further behind in the future. The Navy's latest shipbuilding plan only increases its fleet to 380 ships by 2040, still fewer than the number of Chinese naval vessels today. Carla Babb, VOA News, Norfolk, Virginia.
After hundreds of people were killed in massacres on Syria's coastline last week, locals say widespread calls for peace and justice may give the country's new government a chance to stabilize. But as Heather Murdoch reports, analysts say the humanitarian crisis in Syria is as bad as it's ever been.
Bassem Mahna was in his home with his two sons on Friday morning when armed men stormed into his house.
We refused to evacuate our homes. It was my family, my cousin and I. They entered the house and killed my cousin and two other families. They raided our house and threatened to behead us. They looted everything, money and cars.
Hundreds of people were killed here in Syria's coastal area last week and over the weekend, with some death counts exceeding 1,400. Analysts say many of the killings were acts of revenge for the abuses of dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime, which collapsed in early December. Many of the victims were Alawite, the religious sect of former regime leaders, but not necessarily abusers themselves. Analysts say the fighting was initially provoked by pro-Assad attackers who also committed mass killings. Charles Lister is the head of the Syria Initiative at the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based research institution.
A lid was, I think, quite surprisingly put on a boiling pot on December the 8th. And if anything, it's amazing that it took this long for something to trigger all of those worst sentiments and instincts.
He says that minority leaders, including Alawites, have called on the interim government to deliver justice. Since the assaults, thousands of people have been hiding in this base owned by Russia, which is still viewed as a protector by many Alawites as Moscow was allied with the former regime. But regional leaders say the area is recovering.
The security situation is much better
since the arrival of the security forces and the departure of the armed groups.
But the humanitarian crisis in Syria continues to deepen, according to Lister, and widespread poverty is fueling insecurity.
I think people forget that the humanitarian crisis while Assad was in place in December last year was as bad as it's ever been in Syria after 14 years. But it has continued to worsen since Assad left.
He says international economic sanctions need to be further lifted to allow the government to pay salaries and provide the humanitarian aid that would stabilize the country. Mahna agrees, saying a lasting peace will only follow economic growth.
A peaceful solution is best for Syria's future, but it must come with an economic solution for the people.
Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has said his government will punish all perpetrators of the recent violence, even if some of them are among his supporters. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with our team in Syria, VOA News.
Turning now to Central Africa, where minerals and natural resources are playing a role in bringing peace to the region. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government wants an ally in its battle against M23 rebels and is setting its sights on the United States. And the United States is looking to expand its access to rare earth minerals and is setting its sights on the DRC. Republican strategist Joe Slavik, who is in Kinshasa, spoke with VOA's Carol Van Dam and confirmed that early talks between the Trump administration and the DR Congo government are underway.
Why are these negotiations going on right now between the U.S. and the DR Congo?
I think there's concern about the elevation of conflict between the Rwandans and the Congolese. And of course, the Angolans are working hard in the Luanda process to try to get the parties to stop fighting. And I think the reality is when you look at Eastern Congo, truly the instability is really over mineral rights. And there's been a precedent for over 30 years, basically of Rwanda accessing Congolese mineral rights, I will say unofficially. And maybe the idea is to try to find a mechanism whereby this commerce can be more formalized and, you know, tariffs and whatnot can be used. And instead of spending money on militarization of the region, those funds could be basically reutilized in terms of developing the regional economy, possibly, you know, for the benefit of both countries.
So we know that there's some valuable resources there, and we know that what the U.S. wants. What would the DR Congo government get out of this?
Well, I think, look, the reality is you've had China heavily invested in the Congo. I mean, a lot of it's through, and this has happened under the previous administration, but there was a lot of corruption involved in some of these mega deals. And the under President Tshisekedi, they've tried to reset some of these deals whereby the Chinese have been forced to pay money that was owed to the state. And I think they're trying to diversify their investor base. And, of course, the United States and other Western countries are very interested in coming and developing these assets in Congo. So in the Congolese context, diversifying investment, critical strategic minerals are very important. And I think if they could kind of stabilize the country and, there could be peace with the Rwanda, I think you would see a major uptick in investment. And it would be probably to the benefit of both countries.
How soon do you think a deal could be reached between the U.S. and the DR Congo?
Well, it's not going to be easy. It's going to take some time. And, I think the reality is that, we have to stop beating around the bush that Rwanda has definitely violated the sovereignty of the Congo, that this is unequivocal. And we can have a word salad, as they say. But the reality is that the Rwandans have to kind of push back. I mean, look, you're not going to get peace in Congo unless there's a regional economic benefit for everybody. In this instability, I heard something interesting yesterday that, one of the biggest beneficiaries of all this instability is really China, because major U.S. corporations don't want to come, or any other Western company, they really don't want to come to a war-torn area. So they shy away from that. And the Chinese have the risk appetite. And so really, this instability is to the benefit of China.
That is Republican strategist Joe Slavik speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. While Kinshasa denies directly backing the M23 rebels, it has said its troops are operating in the eastern DRC to defend Rwanda's sovereignty and borders. In addition, Rwanda accuses the DRC of sheltering a militant group that aims to overturn the government in Kinshasa. That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.